We come now to the second of the two lectures by our distinguished guest, Dr. Bernard Boyd, James A. Gray Professor of Biblical Literature at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Dr. Boyd holds at least four earned degrees, including the doctorate in theology, and is a member of a whole litany of learned societies. For the last 10 years, Dr. Boyd has added field archaeology to his many other interests. Not only has he raised money and recruited volunteers for this work, but has busied himself on the field in the actual digging process. It's in the classroom, though, I think, that and on the platform before students that Dr. Boyd, this gifted guest, is at his best. I know for a fact that he's by far the most popular teacher on the University of North Carolina campus in Chapel Hill. And I also know that his religion classes are the first classes to be closed out at registration time. His classroom of 242 chairs is always filled, and students sit in the windows and on the floor and other convenient places. And I'm sure that those of you who heard him for the first time yesterday understand something of the reason for his success with students. He brings a combination of personal integrity, genuine piety, and true scholarly ability that is seldom found on a state university campus and not very often on seminary campus. And this is a dimension that is in great demand. Dr. Boyd, we thank you, sir, for coming our way this time. You're always welcome in this place. You lifted us yesterday to great heights, and we hear you today with eagerness and joy.
Thank you so much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Again this morning, I begin by reading a bit of the Bible, some verses that come from, well, they're selected passages from the prophets. I read them both because I think they are singularly beautiful and because I think they are particularly apropos to what I hope to get said in the next few moments. When Israel was a child, then I loved him, and I called my son out of Egypt. But the more I called him, the more he went away from me. He sacrificed under the Baalim. He burnt incense under graven images. Yet I taught Israel to walk. I took him with my arms. I drew him with cords of a man, with bands of love. And I was to him as he that lift up the yoke upon their jaw, and I laid food before him, and he knew not that I healed him. How can I give you up, Israel? How can I cast you off, Ephraim? How can I make you as Admah? How can I set you as Zeboiim? My heart is turned within me, and my compassions are kindled together, and I will not return to destroy Israel, for I am God and not man. Is Israel my dear son? Is he a darling child? For as often as I think about him, I do earnestly remember him still. Therefore, my heart yearneth for him. And I'll have mercy upon him. And I'll cause him to walk in a straight path wherein no one shall stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Behold, the days come that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the days that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, although I was an husband unto them. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. I will put my law in their inward parts, and I will write it on their hearts. And I shall be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them even unto the greatest of them. And I will forgive their iniquities, and their sins I will remember no more. And may God, who so richly inspired the writing of those words, bless now to our hearts their reading. Last evening, it was my privilege to enjoy what we now call rap session with some of the people in this room, and some, of course, who are doubtless not here this morning. I have reflected much upon that occasion and am glad to report that the questions that were handed me were, in the main, really sharp ones. And if those who are there are in any sense representative of this student body, you've got some sharp young men and women among you. Among the things, however, I do feel is that some of the questions indicated to me that what I tried to get said last morning was not as efficiently said as I earnestly hoped. I was trying to speak to the imperative necessity, I think, of developing a sense of reverence as we walk our way through life. But inasmuch as the particular illustration I chanced to use had to do with a time when I was guilty of most irreverent attitude towards the sacred scriptures, inevitably some of you thought that my remarks were geared especially towards an attitude to the Bible. I would not in any sense back off from anything that I said, but it is true, it is significantly true, as one of the students emphasized last evening, that it can be overdone. And that there are those who hold the Bible in such awe and in such respect that they are really afraid to dig into it. And, oh, I would never want to be interpreted as feeling that way. For I am perfectly convinced that it is our obligation, and as Christian students, our imperative, that we let our minds play across the whole panorama of human experience to begin with, and to concentrate with all the ability at our command upon every word of the Bible's pages, to study, to investigate it, and not to have any blind alleys, not to see any kind of detours that would run us off on a tangent, but to critically to examine this text. It will stand up. Any foundations of our faith which can be destroyed ought to be destroyed. It will not do for us to affect a faith that will not stand up. Any faith we can't look at honestly isn't going to last very long. And any faith that is built on less than a willingness to investigate thoroughly isn't faith at all, it's superstition. And so let us investigate with all that we have. Day by day, try as best I can to lead undergraduate students in that kind of inquiry. And as I do so, I find myself wondering about the strange kind of anomaly that's obvious in this world today, whereby on the one hand, there is this inordinate proliferation of new translations and versions and editions of the Bible. We can hardly keep up with them, can we? And at the same time that they are coming out so manifold, and there is an almost incredible ubiquity of the Bible among us, there at the same time is what we unquestionably recognize as an appalling lack of ignorance of it. And people, for all the fact that it is everywhere about them, somehow or other do not come to grips with it. Well, what are the reasons? And the reasons, of course, are legion, I suppose. The one that I want to speak to just now, and it has to do with all that involves the business of revelation, is the fact that in our excessive modernity, we hold the Bible at least mildly suspect, because whatever else we know about it, we know that it comes from long ago. It is so ancient and we are so modern. It is so Eastern and we are so Western. It is so Oriental and we are so Occidental. And we assume somehow or other that the gulf fixed between where we are and where it came out of is so great that it cannot be actually effectively bridged. And so, in effect, we let it stay where it is. But we don't want to cast it off too far, because after all, whereas we can work our lives fairly satisfactorily without it, when the skies are blue and the fields are green and the rivers are running rich and full, no one can tell just when crisis will come. When death may indeed walk its way in the tenderest place we know, when the homesickness of the soul will get hold upon us in telling fashion, and then, like the mariners in Shakespeare's Tempest, we'll shout, all lost, to prayers, and we'd like to have the Bible around. And so with one half of us, we are glad enough to disregard it. On another half of it, we don't want to shove it away too far. It might just turn out to be needful one of these days. For after all, in very real measure, where would we be without it? All that we know about prayer, really, we learn in the Bible. All that has to do with the origins of the Judeo-Christian religion of which we are a part this morning, we learn in the Bible. Everything in the world we know about the sacraments, we learn in the Bible. Everything that we know about God as an ethical and moral being who seeks encounter with his people, we learn not from some other where, but from these pages. And every single thing that we know about that self-disclosure in Jesus, whereby in consummately beautiful personality and perfect goodness, beauty, and truth, he walked the world of man, we learn from these sacred pages. And so, you see, we dare not be without it for very long. But the fact still remains that it comes from oh so long ago. Now suppose, friends, just suppose, and I have done this, just suppose I made an assignment on class to my students, having first told them that the Bible is different from all other sacred literature in that it has a strong historic orientation, and that we find the historic kernel out of which the drama emerges in the first half of the book of Exodus. Suppose I assign them for the next class the reading of the first 19, or shall I say 20 chapters of Exodus. Let's get the Ten Commandments in. And let's suppose I have some students on class who are interested enough and concerned enough and grade conscious enough to read it. Now I can see them coming to me even before I start class the next time. Professor, I read it. I read it. And in the first chapter, I read about this nameless Pharaoh who did something. And then I read about two midwives who were sufficient to take care of the populace of whoever those people were who lived in Goshen. Then I read about God's calling Moses. And then I read, in no time at all, it came to pass at a lodging place in the way that the Lord sought to kill Moses. And I wondered what was the God of the Bible like. But I kept on reading, and I read that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And then he punished Pharaoh because his heart was hardened. And really, sir, I began to wonder, what is the God of the Bible like? And then I read, after a while, about the people being numbered and about there being 600,000 of them capable of bearing arms, draft age. And I used just a little bit of elementary mathematics, sir. Honest, I did, sir. And it seems to me that would involve a group of people at least 2.5 million, conservatively, maybe 3 million people. And I wondered how well they have packed themselves sardine fashion in the little land of Goshen. But I read on. Then I got to thinking about those two midwives back in the first chapter, and frankly, that bothered me a bit. And, sir, but you shall sign the thing, and I read it all, and I was, by the way, delighted to find out where the Ten Commandments are. I'd heard of them all of my life. But, sir, it says that Moses led the people out and got to some mountain somewhere, and there he erected 12 stones commemorative of each of the 12 tribes. And somebody told me that this tribal division is something that happens later on during the time of the tribal confederation. Professor, do you believe that? And I answer, why, yes. Really, sir? Yeah, I believe. You mean that's true? I say, yes. And then, of course, I have a very bewildered student. What kind of old fogey has he got for a prop? Let us talk about that. It is so important, dear friends, that as we investigate these pages, we remember what kind of literature it is, what kind of revelation it claims to be, the claim it makes for itself, the kind of truth it tries to say, and the kind of truth it is not even in any sense interested in trying to get said. And there is so great disparity there. Just an aside just now, I want to get back to this, but this is an illustration I've used many times, and 3 or 4 of you have doubtless heard me use it. It's nothing much except that it spoke to me so impressively at the time. It was some years ago now. I chanced to be at lunch, luncheon, and across the table from a singularly attractive young woman. During the course of the meal, I chanced to say, "May I pass the bread?" And she said, "No, thank you." And then with a persistence that I cannot even explain to myself just now, I said, "Won't you have some bread?" And she said, "No, thank you." And then she said, I heard her say, "That's not Hollywood bread." And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said it aloud, "That's not Hollywood bread." And I said, "Tell me more." And then she began to explain. "I didn't know about this stuff. Hollywood bread," she said, and I'm making up the mathematical statistics now. Frankly, I've forgotten them. This is just after that. She says, "Ordinary bread has 125 calories to a slice. Hollywood bread just has 40. And I said, "No kidding." And that kind of got her going. Well, she was incredible. She was incredible. That lady knew how many calories there are in a cube of sugar. She knew the caloric content of the amount of garden peas, those of us who speak a lot call them banquet berries, that can be balanced on the tongs of a fork. She turned what had been a delightful luncheon into a laboratory experiment. Now, mind you, I am not in the slightest complaining. Her amazing information about calories was paying off. She looked great. But the reason I'm taking your time to tell you this now is that a moment later, I chanced to remember that I had heard that she had recently married. And I said, "Oh, by the way, how's Bob? Tell me about Bob." And you know, she couldn't. When we were talking about calories, she was fantastic. She had encyclopedic data, and the words were flippantly on her tongue as she revealed to me all that she had learned about how many calories there are in a cube of sugar. I said, "How's Bob?" And she fizzled. Oh, there came into her eyes, that cheeks, that flush, and into her eyes that light, the light that never was on land or sea. But she couldn't tell me about Bob. You see, the fact is, Bob matters. And there's no way to say, let me run the risk of appearing ridiculous. So anxious am I to get this said by reminding you of what she didn't say. She didn't say, "Oh, Bob, I love him with 100% of my being. I love him. I love him to the extent that when I think of him, my basal metabolism does thus and so, and warm chills run up and down my spine." The categories that she applied a while ago fail completely here. It wasn't by accident that a long time ago Gertie said, "The highest can't be said, it has to be acted." I happen to be a very happily married man. And for how many years has it been? 29, I believe. Yes, I have been trying to say to a certain woman, "I love you." And I haven't said it yet. The words are good, but they're not good enough. They don't get the truth across. Last evening, if it were not chilly, and I think doubtless it was not, some southeastern student and young lady were walking together, or maybe stationary, and the boy said to her, "I love you." And in just a moment, he said, "I love you." And in just a moment, he said, "I love you. What's the matter? Is the record broken?" No, he just realizes that he can't get it said. The highest can't be said. Yes, my love of my wife is a fact. And yet, I don't know how to tell it. My love of my country is a fact. I consider myself a patriot in that fine sense of the term used to have. Tragically, in our present age, it's gotten some very reactionary and unfortunate connotations. But I love this land. I think anyone who habitually disparages it does so because he hasn't lived in other lands. We have, in large measure, oftentimes forfeited our precious privilege of moral leadership in the world's life. We have sometimes vitiated our potential for that kind of leadership. I confess that there have been times that I have been a bit embarrassed to be recognized as an American citizen in some other way, but the plain truth is, in the whole, God bless the USA. I never thought of it much. The Star Spangled Banner, for goodness sakes, is just something you endure before the kickoff. And then one day, I happened to be with a group of United States Marines. God bless them, they're the salt of the earth. We were at Okinawa. After 90 seemingly endless days, the island had been, our verb was secured. It was ours. And the fellows wanted to have some sort of little ceremony. Well, they are unlimited in their imagination. It wasn't any difficulty getting something for a flagstaff, and we had Old Glory there, and we could raise the flag all right. But those incredible fellows came, made up the most motley kind of band you can possibly imagine, anything would in the world for an instrument. And I stood there one afternoon in that distant well, and I saw my country's flag unfurled, and I heard those fellows make go with the Star Spangled Banner, and I began to understand in some measure what love of country means, for my mind and my heart and my spirit leaped over the ever so many thousand miles, and I thought of this land. How do I say it? I don't. Breathes out a man with soul so dead, who never to himself hath said, this is mine own, my native land, whose heart is near within him burned when wandering on a foreign strand. Well, that poetry, that comes a little bit closer. My love of the church is a fact. I'm excited about the Church of Jesus Christ. And in my travels, whether near or far, I always finding myself, especially when I am in a new town, looking around for the church steeples. Something to remind me that here or there or there or some other where is another church building. Sometimes they are gorgeous, appealingly beautiful. Sometimes they are architectural monstrosities, but nonetheless they symbolize the one institution in all the world's life that is dedicated uncompromisingly to the good and the true and the beautiful, and I love it with a passion. And I have tried in all of my adult life to transmit to others something of my conviction that the church is the body of Christ, badly broken, but nonetheless acting redemptively when at her best, wherever she is, anywhere in the world. I know it to the marrow of my bones, I believe it, and I don't know how to get it said. And my love of the Christ is a fact. And if I know my heart, it is the greatest of all facts. And all of my adult life, I have tried to say to others something of his incomparable and consummate beauty, and I have muffed it every time. Now, to get back to Exodus. There's so much difference, friends, in the way that your history prof back at college or university would write a learned article, and in the way some authors, we are not, do not know their names, are not in any sense sure of their identity, authored the first half of the book of Exodus. There's a great deal of difference between this kind of history and anything approaching modern historiography, a great deal of difference. Is this history? Well, in a modern sense, no. It won't stand up historically, but is not supposed to. That's not it, what it's for. It's not trying to tell us how many calories there are in a cube of sugar, if I now make the analogy. It's trying to enter that other realm. And let me not seem irreverent, but I'm going to continue the analogy. It's going to try to answer the question, how about Bob? It is a nation's privileged recollection of a transcendently significant event, which event they interpreted as explaining the very reason for their being, the meaning of their existence. They saw that event, or rather that series of events, as that which gave the nation birth. Here was that which effected a covenant relationship between a people, a servile people, and a God who revealed himself. And they try to get it said as they, throughout the centuries, treasure the memory of it. Exodus 1 through 20 is not history in the way that a 1974 history book would be history. It is history in quite another way. It is salvation history It is the record of the treasured memory of a people of highly significant event. Surely you and I know enough about what history is and what history isn't to know that history is not the record of past event, but the record of past remembered event. And remembered event because interpreted event, because certain happenings were interpreted to have inordinate significance because they saw that as being in some special way evidential data as to the redemptive activity of their God. Their God reached down and saw a people and heard a people's cry and knew their suffering and came down to them and brought them out. And then they have the memory of all that strange series of events that we just kind of cursorily call the plagues, which they looked back upon and they thought, oh, how great is our God. They did not know any kind of dichotomy between the natural and the supernatural. They wouldn't have asked the question, is this miraculous or is this non-miraculous? They didn't see it that way. This word miracle is a modern invention. They saw those events, whatever the events were, as evidences of the redemptive activity of their God. Their God brought them out. I think it is most one of the most remarkable things in the Bible that whereas this experience is alluded to time and time again through every passing century, not one single time are the people ever represented as saying, we got ourselves out of Egypt. Not one single time. Rather, our God brought us out. Now, the significance of these chapters has to do, first, with the fact that at a place in time and at a point of time, something happened. Whatever happened, they saw as the activity of their God. Now, what really matters is that it hasn't quit happening. Oh, I hope I have the wit and the wisdom to get something now said. Some years ago, I was talking about the Passover event to a group of students. And I was talking about the Seder meal that our Jewish friends have in their Passover experience. And I was telling my students that on the basis of what I had read, it must be as consummately beautiful concrete symbolism as anywhere in the world. And some Jewish student in the class got the hint, as I indicated, that all I knew was what I had read in the book. That not being Jewish, I had never been identified with it. And afterwards, she came up and said, Professor Boyd, I'm sure that my family would be delighted to have you and your family join us at Seder next Passover. She happened to be from Charlotte. I thanked her very much. I was fearful that it was just a passing idea and that would be no follow through. But sure enough, in a short time, we got a letter from her parents inviting us to drive to Charlotte to join with that Jewish family at Passover. How glad I am that we could go. An evening I shall never forget. I will not take your time to recap all that is involved. I will simply remind you that for a week previously, the lady of the household had been industriously cleaning up the house every possible way. No dust, nothing. The house beautiful. I remind you that the night before, the father of the house had gone through every room of the house looking for any kind of leaven. And then, finding none, of course, he would shout out the declaration, I now declare that any leaven that is in this house is non-existent. And so now the house is ready. And the evening comes. And the table is set. And there is spotless damask. And every single thing on that table means something. There are the three loaves of matzoth. Here is the harasheth. Here is the roasted shank bone of a lamb. Here is the roasted egg, the one thing that comes down from a pre-Mosaic pagan springtime festival ceremony. Here are the four glasses of wine that symbolize the four promises God makes to Moses in Exodus 6, 6, and 7. And in the middle of the table, this large goblet ready for Elijah in the event that Elijah should come during the process of the meal. There is that oh so dramatic moment when the young son runs to the front door and throws the door open in the hope that possibly during the process of the meal Elijah had returned and now he would be welcomed. But the reason I remind you of this follows now. There is the moment in the service when the young son addresses the father, who as father is acting as priest within the family, and he says, "Father, why is this night different from any other night?" And the father answers, "Son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out with a mighty arm and with an outstretched hand." Did you realize, friends, that this very day, all over the world's life, and the diaspora is genuinely real, this very day, all over the world's life, dedicated Jews will pause to look heavenward and say, "Thou didst bring me out of the land of Egypt." I don't know where in your prophets are dating the Exodus event, whether 1290 or 1250 or 1225 or 1220 or whenever it be. The fact is, that event historically took place somewhere in the late Bronze Age, you will agree. And we are living towards the end of the 20th century of the unfolding of the Christian drama. And our Jewish friends today will say, "Thou didst bring me out of the land of Egypt." In the book of Deuteronomy, a book I dearly love, the aged Moses is represented as standing on the side of Nebo yonder, and the assembled congregation of the people whom he has led so long are there. From his vantage point, he can look across Jordan and see the promised land, to which land he will not be privileged to go. Now, the text has just finished saying very, very explicitly about the passage of the years and that how that all the original participants in the Exodus event are dead. There's a new generation now. The text has just made that perfectly clear. Now listen to Moses. "It was not with your fathers, but with you that the Lord made this covenant." Some years ago, Bernard Anderson of Princeton Seminary, formerly of Drew, authored a little article called "The Contemporaneity of the Bible," I believe the way it was entitled, in which he so impressively gets across this oh-so-significant point. It is what Nels Frey some years ago in whimsical fashion called the isness of the was, the presentness of the past, the interpretation of event in terms of its continuity. That is why Joshua 24 is so important to us. I can remember, friends, and some years ago trying to teach this part of the Bible and getting to Joshua, and I would talk about the first 11 chapters as that highly systematized and schematic presentation of the conquest, and then I would point out to them that chapter 12 is a kind of recap of the conquest, and that 13 through 22 is a long effort to give interpretation to or explanation of the various areas in the land the various tribes were assigned. And then I said 23 and 24, I said they're farewell addresses of Joshua. He's done his job and he's going now and he's saying goodbye. I said there's some fine quotes in the chapters, "Choose you this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." I said, some good quotes and nice to remember, but except for that, that's about it. Let's go on to the next book. And what did Norman Snaith say just a few years ago when he got to the 24th chapter of Joshua? He says, probably the most significant chapter in the Old Testament. Well, now, I'm not saying that. I'm very careful about that kind of hyperbolic expression, but at the same time, it is tremendously significant. And I should like to believe that a large number of you are identifying that chapter now. That is that perfectly gorgeous depiction of covenant renewal ceremony, whereby, after the passage of the years, anyone who had felt himself not incorporated in that covenant community, by doing the same thing again, by it happening again, are themselves incorporated. Any stranger in the land, Anyone who, for any reason whatsoever, had not been participant in the tremendous event now indeed becomes an included one. And it happened time and time and time again. We, thanks to the work of Von Rod, concentrate upon the cultic credo in ancient Israel, yes. And we read them, and we are impressed by the fact that, important as this Sinai event was in the traditions of the people, they are not mentioned in the credos. Now, it's not mentioned in the credos, not for the reason that in an Apostles' Creed or something like that, there should be no allusion to the vicarious atonement. Nobody argued that. I mean, they are not included in the credos for the reason that, as they engage in recitation theology, they are not saying that something happened way back yonder. They are saying that it happened now, that it's happening right now. What I want to leave with you this morning, folks, is this. What do you suppose would happen if you and I, we're sons of Abraham, you know, we're one with this covenant relationship, you know, what do you suppose would happen if you and I, privileged members of the Christian community and privileged called ambassadors of the gospel who have a message to proclaim, what do you suppose would happen if we would quit turning what ought to be our strength into a weakness? For that's what we do in Christendom. Christmas comes, and we sentimentally talk about the little baby in Bethlehem. And we project ourselves back yonder 20 centuries to a certain event which we believe happened. And it's a historic event of long ago. And I submit that this Christ of ours is not content to wave at us from 20 centuries back yonder. What do you suppose would happen that on Easter morn we should not interpret Easter in terms of how much faith we can muster to believe that the tomb was empty, and interpret it rather in terms of his rising right now? What would happen in our Christian commitment and in our Christian conviction and our Christian message if we should take advantage of the magnificent historic background out of which our tradition comes and see it in terms of its present? Christ was born once in Bethlehem's stable to prove, of course, that he is forever born. He died one Friday afternoon to show that he forever dies. He rose one brilliant Sunday morning to show that he forever rises. Historic event, thank God for that. But the contemporary quality of that historic event and our awareness and appreciation of it, thank God for the potential of that. This book that we ought to approach reverently, for it is our source book for about all that we know in religious matters, is not designed to tell us how many calories there are. It will not reveal to us anything ascertainable to by us by scientific investigation, philosophic inquiry. It's designed to tell us things about God, things about man, things about the relationship of man to man, things about the relationship of man to God, things about the self-disclosure of God, which otherwise we could never know. And that is the gist of what Revelation means, no matter where I am in the text. Maybe I'm way back yonder at the very beginning of the story. Maybe I'm reading the Adam and Eve in Eden story. Now, as a student, I must investigate. And I'm willing to agree, and it was no easy decision to make, that initially the Adam and Eve story is an ideological tale. Then I see someone, I call him the Yahwist, you call him what you will. I see someone lifting up that ideological tale, slicing off all of the polytheistic aspects and crass aspects of it, and giving it a theological thrust that is powerful. I see editors taking these stories and placing them in the order in which we now find them, and I see that story mirroring the picture of myself and of yourself every day. Adam and Eve, man and woman, creatures. And because creatures made by a creator, and owing a special kind of relationship, enjoying a special kind of relationship to that creator. And as long as I am sensitive to that, then I find a sense of unity within myself, a sense of kinship with you, and a sense of the reality of God that otherwise I could not have. But if, like my forebears, Adam and Eve, I violate my creatureness by disobedience, I break that communion, and I lose Eden. And so I go on to the next story, and the next, and the next. And in the 11th chapter, there is that story, obviously ideological, in two different fashions that we call the Tower of Babel story. And mankind says, listen to him now. I will build myself a city, and I'll make myself a tower, the top of which will reach into heaven, and I'll make a name for myself. That's the 11th chapter. And boy, oh boy, is that mankind at his worst. And is it distressingly mirrored in the culture of our present moment? And then there is the 12th chapter, where there is the beginning of the magnificent condescension of God. And the redemptive activity takes place, begins. And through the rest of the course of the scriptures, I see the redemptive activity operative. There is, I wish I had checked this, it's in the prologue, I think, to John's Joseph the Provider, whereby we are, in imagination, taken into the councils of heaven, and we are presented with an angelic chorus engaged in articulate tedium of praise to the author and preserver of all life. And as they engage in those praises, they are interrupted by a messenger who comes to bring the word that God has just announced that he plans to make a world and put people on it and endow them with freedom. And the angels try to muster the courage to say, oh, he better not do that. He better not do that. If he makes the world and puts people in it, in no time at all, they will be worshiping themselves, and the world and the life of man in the world will go on in a wild and a willful and ruinous career. He better not do that. In a short time thereafter, there comes the messenger to bring the sad information that God had indeed made the world and had indeed put people on it and indeed had given them freedom. And sure enough, in no time at all, even said, my apple, and well, you know the rest of the story. And now the angels say, we could have told him so. When another messenger comes in to bring the glad intelligence that God has already announced plans whereby, in mighty impingement upon human history, he will enter human history and win back mankind to himself. And then the angels say, and this is why I remember the little story to tell it you. And then the angels say, how he doth mightily condescend. The 12th chapter of Genesis begins the revelation of the mighty condescension of God. The mighty condescension of God, whereby he takes the Tower of Babel and turns it upside down. And pushes us as he pushes history to that time when, in bewilderingly beautiful experience, a little group of people gathered one day at Pentecost sense the unprecedented onrush of the divine spirit, and sense that that lost brotherhood exists no longer, and they can reach across the aisle and reach across the continents, and one man can shake hands with brother man. I began early in the hour in alluding to a war experience. I don't like to do that very much. You'll allow this in conclusion, please. I was privileged to be with the group of Marines who represented the Marine Corps in their initial landing in Tokyo Bay on the Great Surrender Day. We landed not knowing whether it was a gigantic hoax, and as it were hitting the beach just like some other island out there. But upon landing, in no time at all, we found out that they were surrendered all right. They were beaten all right. And oh my soul, had we known Hiroshima and Nagasaki would not have been necessary, would that we could push those things back up into the sky. They were surrendered. That very afternoon, I did something which, as I reflect upon it, I do not know how in the world I could have been so stupid as to have essayed it, or how anybody let me get by with it. Apparently, I made my way through past a God. There must have been some God. All by myself, I walked alone, I emphasize, up the streets of Yokosuka, Japan. I'd been out there for a long time, and all I'd seen was swaying palm trees, and now we were with a part of a naval base, a part of a large Oriental city, and I wanted to see what the Orient was like, and so I went. Mind you, a few hours ago, we were determined enemies, as we had been for seemingly endless years. All by myself, I walked uptown, and then I was sorry. Not because of fear, but because of embarrassment. Those people were not simply bowing in that gorgeously polite way they have a way of doing, but they were throwing themselves abjectly to the ground. And I felt like no conquering hero. I wanted to turn around. I wanted to go, and I didn't know how to get. So I began walking sideways, window shopping, so I wouldn't meet anybody's eye. And as I kind of edged this way up the street, my eye went into a long, narrow, semi-darkened place. It was a photographer's shop. Here in the front were photographs. As I looked back, I saw a young man there. He smiled at me. I interpreted the smile to mean, come in, and I went in. And he greeted me, and I said, hello. He pointed to a chair, and I sat down and said, thank you. And then I remembered, oh, how well I remembered, that I'd already used up all of the Japanese I knew. On shipboard, I had learned how to say hello and thank you, and now it had all been used in the first few seconds. Well, the man looked at me, and he noticed upon my beat-up old uniform, I had just etched a cross. We had long since tossed away insignia out there. I had etched a cross. I wanted the fellows to know that I try to represent the cause of religion among them. That young man saw that cross, and immediately he urged me to stay where I was. He ran up some rickety stairs, down which he might well have thrown a hand grenade. I didn't think of that. In a few moments, he was back down with some pictures in his hand. They were religious pictures. They were skillfully done pictures. They were geared to an Oriental motif. For far too often, we have tried to thrust the Western culture upon the Eastern world. They were beautifully done. Down at the bottom, Methodist Publishing Company, Nashville, Tennessee. The man didn't speak any English, and I spoke two words of Japanese. As long as I was in that area, every time I went uptown, I went to see my photographer buddy. You are now looking at the one man, save except for General Douglas MacArthur, who's the most often photographed American ever to visit Japan, I think. Every time I saw him, he took my pictures some more than what anything else to do. when suddenly I found out on a few hours' notice that there was a ship named the Typhoon in Yokohama ready to sail, and I could get on it if I could get there in time. I dashed about getting myself ready and making my office ready for my successor. I had to dash uptown to my photographer friend to say a fond farewell. I've thought of that young man thousands of times. I dare to believe he's thought of me a good many times. There isn't any north or south or east or west or border or breed of birth when two of man, God's creatures come face to face, though they come from the ends of the earth. As I thought that, I thought about the time when some months earlier we were released from active combat. We thought for a few days to a lovely valley where there was surcease from activity. We were within hearing of the guns, but everything was calm. I remember the day so well because for the first time ever, I had been able to get hold of a litter, a stretcher, on which I was going to sleep that night. Every night, somebody got some of them, but I lacked the prestige or the position to get one. That night, I was to have one, and it was a wonderful situation. I carefully dug my foxhole, just the right architectural dimensions for a litter. It was a beautiful foxhole. I had my litter down in it. I just couldn't wait. It was a veritable, boy, was that a beauty rest. I couldn't wait for nightfall. I was down there practicing when the young interpreter came and says, "Chaplain, you're needed. There's an Okinawan woman over there in desperate need of surgery, and our surgeons are free now from any kind of necessity of dealing with the fellows, but she was screaming and she won't consent to surgery. She's so brainwashed to think that we are fiendish beasts, and so please come and tell her that we mean well and ought to help her." And I said, "Oh, go away, leave me alone. I don't know how to talk an Okinawan woman to submit to surgery," and then I knew I had to go. And I didn't have to ask where, because I could hear the screams. I made my way to this lean-to of a tent sort of thing that was passing for a hospital. I went in, and here was that screaming woman. And I was wearing those old battle fatigues, and there was a cross on my lapel. And her eyes met that cross. And suddenly the scream stopped, and the lady smiled at me. I turned to the surgeon and said, "I'm sure you may operate when you're ready." Well, in the exigency of a combat situation, you can't foretell, of course. Something happened and we were called back into combat, and I didn't get to use my butyl rest that night, nor can I report to you upon the results of the surgery. But I do know this. One view of a crudely made cross was enough. In hoc signo, fellows. In hoc signo. Something's happened in the world. Something's happened in the world. Immediately to turn how many months of years of brainwashing into the calm confidence that here was love and here was compassion. Because God has pulled it off. He has pulled it off. Men build their Babel towers and say, "I will make a name for myself." God says, "I will make your name great." And he has pulled it off. We have a message to proclaim. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Boyd. We're in your debt. You've helped us take another step in our pilgrimage to be more than we are. And we thank you very much. You're dismissed.